Welcome to this evening's meeting of the Aristotelian Society. It's my great pleasure to introduce our speaker, Professor Michael Smith. Michael is the McCosh Professor of Philosophy at Princeton University, and he's also an honorary fellow in the School of Historical and Philosophical Studies at Melbourne University. He's previously held appointments at Wadham College, Oxford, Monash, and the Research School of Social Studies at ANU, as well as a number of other visiting professorships. His primary research interests include ethics, moral psychology, philosophy of mind and action, political philosophy, and the philosophy of law. He's the author of The Moral Problem, for which he was awarded the American Philosophical Association Book Prize in 1994, Ethics and the A Priori, Selected Essays on Moral Psychology and Metaethics, and he's the co-author with Frank Jackson and Philip Petit of Mind, Morality and Explanation, Selected Collaborations. The title of Michael's talk this evening is Agent and Patient, or What We Learn About Reasons for Action by Reflecting on Process of Thought Cases. Thanks very much, Michael.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation, and thank you for coming. It's great to see some old friends in the audience. This is my habit. I tend to make a pretty comprehensive handout. So if you find that you have nodded off and you don't know where we are in the talk, you can pretty much follow the whole talk by reading through the handout. Okay? So, let's start. So the question is whether we can draw substantive conclusions about the reasons for action that agents have from premises about desires of their idealized counterparts. Now, everyone agrees that you can do that if you stipulate that the concept of a reason for action has some link with idealization, where the norms of idealization are the norms of, say, morality. In fact, that looks like a standard version of virtue theory, the kind articulated by Rosalind Hursthaus. But that's not my question. My question is whether if you start from premises to do with the desires of ideal agents, where the norms of idealization are norms internal to agency itself, whether you can derive substantive conclusions about reasons for action. So now let me just tell you what I think those norms are. This is my default assumption. These norms, I think, are norms having to do with that govern what it is for someone to have and exercise capacities for knowing about the world in which they live and for realizing their desires in it. So that's the question. Can you derive substantive conclusions about the reasons for action agents have from premises about desires of agents who have and robustly have maximal capacities and robustly exercise those capacities to know the world in which they live and realize their desires in it? And my answer is, yes, you can. Now, that sounds, I'm sure, to many of you as though it must be wrong, because Bernard Williams famously argued from premises like those, which I'm going to call Humean premises about the nature of what it is, of what the norms are that govern agency. Williams famously argued from premises like that to the conclusion that there are no substantive constraints on the reasons for action that agents have. And so precisely what I'm saying is that Williams is wrong. There's something wrong with Williams's own conception of the way in which his own account of the norms that govern agency, what exactly they tell us about the reasons for action that agents have. So that's what I'm saying. I'm saying you can get from Williams-style, Humean, anti-rationalist premises about the norms that govern agency to substantive, rationalist, or Kantian conclusions about the reasons for action that agents have. That is exactly the argument. There's no... If I'm confused, it's the argument that's confused. Okay, so... So now, I'm going to argue for this in a way that I think is rather novel, But I want to emphasise from the get-go that the argument, in fact, has a lot in common with an argument of John Rawls's. So Rawls famously asks us to imagine a choice situation in which we are ignorant of our own identity and we're ignorant of our idiosyncratic desires and concerns. And he asks us to imagine, in a situation where we're like that, the original position as he calls it, to imagine ourselves choosing principles to govern the basic structure of society. And he thinks that the principles of justice are just whatever principles would be chosen in such a choice situation. Now, if you're a Humean, you must find Rawls's thought experiment utterly baffling. Because if you abstract away from your idiosyncratic concerns, given that every choice is the expression of an idiosyncratic concern, there's nothing for you to choose from. Right? So Rawls must be thinking it's possible to make a choice, to make a choice, even after you've abstracted away from your idiosyncratic concerns. And that reveals something important, I think, about how Rawls was thinking of practical reason. He was thinking that practical reason was reasoning from desires that you would have simply in virtue of being capable of making choice at all. And moreover, he thought that those desires, the ones that you would have to have simply in virtue of being able to make a choice at all, that they had certain concrete upshots. What you'd choose are the two principles of justice. Now, the argument that I'm going to give is a lot like that. It's a lot like Rawls's argument. And I'm going to focus on some cases in which similar kind of abstractions, I'm inviting you to think in terms of similar kinds of abstractions. Okay? And it'll be good to keep Rawls's argument in the back of your mind as we go forward. Because if Rawls and I are doing the same thing, that is, if we're both just limiting the nature of the norms that govern agency as such, then a measure of whether or not we're onto something should be something like a convergence in our results. And what I'm going to say to you at the end is that the result I come up with is remarkably Rawlsian in its content. It's slightly different for reasons I'll explain, but it's remarkably similar. And that gives me some reason for optimism that I'm not just inventing this out of thin air, that there's really something here that I'm getting onto. Okay, so that's the basic structure of the argument. So now, let's get to the meat of the talk. So what I've said is that there's something wrong with Williams's own conception of what the norms are that govern ideal agents. Now, Williams thinks, as I do, that an ideal agent has two kinds of capacity. He has a capacity to know the world in which he acts and to realise his desires in it. All of the norms that Williams imagines governing correct deliberation are all derivable from those two basic ideas, that these are the capacities that agents have. Now, the question to ask is whether that conception of agency already contains the seeds of a problem. And what I'm going to try and convince you of is that it does. It already contains the seeds of a problem. And the problem is that these two capacities, though they look like they're made for each other, are in fact at war with each other. And that what the nature of the war between them is, if you like, a kind of incoherence between the two capacities. And in order to really give an account of what these norms of idealisation are, the first thing we have to do is to bring these two capacities into some sort of coherence with each other. That's the first step in the argument. So now, let me tell you why I think these capacities are at war with each other. Think of the norm of desire realisation. What that says is that if you're a Williams-style Humean, it means that you have the capacity to realise your desires no matter what their content. Okay? So now let's imagine someone who has a desire to believe that Pete. That's his desire. Now imagine that agent having a maximal capacity for desire realization, which he robustly exercises. That is, he exercises it through a whole range of possible variations in the contents of his desires. So now, if he exercises his capacity to realize his desires, he'll end up believing that P. But he'll believe that P, whether or not P is supported by the reasons that, or the evidence that's available to him. And so whether or not P is something that he would end up believing if he was to exercise his capacity to know the world in which he lives. So that makes it look like these two capacities are at war with each other in the following sense. It's impossible to imagine an agent who robustly exercises these two capacities at the same time. So now, just in order to see why that's true, imagine someone who just, as it happens, doesn't happen to desire to believe particular things. They just have desires to, you know, do things like eat and drink and be merry. Nonetheless, if this person has the robust capacity to realise their desires, then they have the capacity to realise their desire to believe that P in the possible world in which they happen to have the desire to believe that P. And now they're in the same bind as the agent I imagined who did have the desire to believe that P. That is to say, in that world, the person can't exercise their capacity to realise their desires without failing to exercise their capacity to know the world in which they live, if it just so happens that that's a world in which P isn't supported, is neither true nor supported by the evidence available to them. Okay, now the question is, what is the probative force of this observation about the two capacities? Now, here's a first possibility. A first possibility is, oh, that's tough. That's just what it's like to be an ideal agent. You're just subject to two norms. And when we ask the question, are you an ideal agent? It's a bit like Olympic diving. You know how in Olympic diving, you know, there's a score. Sorry, this seems appropriate given the time of the time. So you know how this one's for, I wish I'd put numbers on this. This one's for difficulty of dive and this one's for execution. So it'd be a bit like that. You'd say, how rational is this guy here? And so you'd have a number for how well he knows his world, and then you'd have this separate number for how well he's realising his desires. And you'd have to give the two numbers, because you would know in advance that these two capacities are potentially push in different directions. The exercise of the two capacities push in different directions. Right? So I'm going to call that the separate scores conception. So one upshot you might think is that, well, that's just tough. Rationality is just like that. Norms of ideal agency are just like that. There's just it's just the separate scores conception. That's just what you're committed to. Now, that is possible. But the thing to notice is that when you disaggregate the norms governing desire realization and the norms governing knowledge acquisition, pride of place is being given to norms of coherence. Your beliefs have to cohere with the evidence that's available to you if you're to have knowledge. Your desires, your intrinsic desires and your means-end beliefs have to cohere with each other and so generate out instrumental desires with corresponding contents and proportional to the confidence levels and so on. So norms of coherence are being given pride of place, but you've got this separate scores conception. So a good question to ask is whether it's possible to come up with a conception that induces more coherence. Because if it's possible, it's preferable. It's preferable for reasons that are internal to the conception itself. Now, how might you do that? Well, I can think of three ways. One is you just insist that rationality or norms of idealization are just about knowledge acquisition. That's all it's about. Of course, there's this natural fact about animals like us that we have desires and we aim to realise them, but that's got nothing to do with rationality. That's one way. There would then only be the one score, right? You'd only get the score for knowledge acquisition. That would induce more coherence in the ideal agent's psychology because the rest of it would just be natural noise, so to speak. The other view, of course, would be to do the opposite, to say, oh, actually, rationality is only about desire realization. Knowledge acquisition, that's got nothing to do with rationality. You can sort of assess the epistemic features of the beliefs that people have, but that's just got nothing to do with how rational they are. And again, that would be to have a single score. You'd just be fixing on how well they realise their desires. So you'd get a more coherent picture of what it is to be an ideal agent. But the trouble with these two is just the one that you can imagine. Namely, you've really got to swallow this bitter pill that the failure to have beliefs, having beliefs that fail to cohere with evidence, is no comment on the rationality of the believer. That's very hard to believe. Or alternatively, you've got to swallow the idea that instrumental failure is no comment on the irrationality of the agent. That's also very hard to believe. So neither of these two ways of inducing more coherence looks very promising. Now, but there is another way, and that's the way I want to try and pursue. Another way would be to suppose that what this tells you is that an ideal agent has to have certain coherence-inducing desires. Because if only they cared about the right things, then they wouldn't be running into trouble when they try and exercise their capacities to know the world in which they live. So here's an obvious candidate. The ideal agent desires not to interfere with his exercise of his capacity to know the world in which he lives. Now, if the ideal agent had that desire, and it was part of what it is to be an ideal agent to have such a desire, then when this desire would have to be dominant. It would have to be dominating all of the rest of the desires that he has. When you score him for desire realisation, right, he'll have to be leaving himself free to form beliefs about the world in which he lives. And so the score for knowledge realisation will be a pure function of the extent to which he has the capacity and exercises it for knowing the world in which he lives. And that's going to induce more coherence between the two capacities. Okay. That's the first step. That's the first premise of this argument. So that's my conclusion. My conclusion is these two capacities have an internal problem of coherence with each other, and there's a preferred way, given the norms that are internal to the very idea of the ideal agent. There are reasons to prefer the option that says certain desires are constitutive of what it is to be an ideal agent. In particular, it's constitutive of being an ideal agent that you've got to have a desire that you don't interfere with the exercise of your own capacity to know the world in which you live. Now that actually, in a way, I could just stop the talk now. I could just stop. I've now proved my point. Because if following Williams, what people have reason to do is a function of what they would want themselves to do if they deliberated correctly, that is, if they were ideal, then we now know something about every single one of us. We all have a reason to leave ourselves free, or not to interfere, with our own exercise of our capacities to know the world in which we live, or belief formation. That is a substantive conclusion about reasons for action that we now draw directly from the norms of idealisation once you kind of properly face up to the fact that those norms have an internal problem of there's a problem of internal coherence of making these norms cohere with each other, and we solve that problem by admitting that certain desires are constitutive of what it is to be an ideal agent. So I could just stop there, but I'm not going to. Because as soon as you see this is a kind of foot in the door argument. As soon as you see that there's a desire that's constitutive of what it is to be ideal. Actually, I'm just going to say fully rational. That's not a very nice term, actually, for what I'm after, but I'll just say that, just because it's easier than the mouthful of saying ideal, where the norms of idealisation are the norms internal to agency itself. I'll just say fully rational. So once you see that there is a desire that's constitutive of what it is to be fully rational, that naturally prompts a question. Are there any other desires that are constitutive of what it is to be fully rational? Now, the first thing that I want to notice is that here's an interesting fact about agents. That is, people who have the capacity to know the world in which they live and realise their desires in it. That is, they exist over time. And not only do they exist over time, but their capacity to know the world in which they live often requires diachronic effort. So let's just think about a case. This is now moving into the... This is now the second premise of my argument, if you like. We're now moving into these process of thought cases that are going to be my motif for the rest of the talk. So I want you to think about a case in which someone is trying to figure out whether P is the case. And if it turns out that it is the case, he's then going to move on and try and figure out whether P supports Q. And if it does, he's then going to move on and draw the conclusion that Q. So right now, though, what he's doing is he's trying to figure out whether or not P is true. Now, the question is, what does this person have to be like if he has and if he possesses maximal capacities for knowing the world in which he lives and realising his desires in it robustly? Now, the answer is, this case is actually exactly like the synchronic case. It's just that the desire that we've imagined to be present, namely the desire that you don't interfere with your current exercise of your capacity to know the world in which you live, is one whose satisfaction or realisation will not be sufficient to prevent you from acting on idiosyncratic desires to believe that not Q in the future without regard to whether or not Q is supported by the evidence or not. Right? So it looks like, for the very reasons we've already given, you're going to have to think, given that we have these diachronic cases of exercising our capacity, that you're going to have a second desire as well. You're going to have a desire not just to not interfere with your own present exercise of your capacity to know the world in which you live, but also to have the desire not to interfere with your future exercise of your capacity to know the world in which you live. Only so will you not be in a diachronic bind that's really just structurally like the synchronic bind that I imagined initially. Okay, now, is that enough? No, that's not enough either. Because it seems to me that merely by reflecting on what it is to be a synchronically and diachronically ideal agent, right? So now we've got that idea in mind. You've got to be a synchronically and diachronically ideal agent, where what it means to be an ideal agent is that you possess and exercise maximal capacities for knowing the world in which you live and realising your desires in it. I think that very fact tells you something about how you're going to apportion effort in certain crucial cases. So let's think about the following case. Imagine that you've got a slight unpleasant headache. It's the case that I imagined just a second ago, just to fix ideas. It's that you're trying to figure out whether or not P, if it turns out to be true, you're going to go on to figure out whether or not P supports Q, and if it does, you'll go on to draw the conclusion of Q. Okay. Now, but right now, you're trying to figure out whether or not P is true, and you have a slightly unpleasant headache. Now, you have one pill that you could take, and it would get rid of this headache. As it happens, this headache is not at all interfering with your enterprise of trying to figure out whether P is true. I'm just stipulating. However, you know something. You know that as you invest more effort in thinking about all these things that you're trying to figure out whether or not they're true, you will get a pretty serious headache later. And if you've used up your pill now, you won't have it to take later when you have a splitting headache that is going to interfere with your exercise of your capacity to, say, figure out whether P supports Q or to draw the conclusion that Q, or however you want to think about it. Right? You know that. Now, if you have a maximal capacity to know the world in which you live and you robustly exercise that capacity diachronically, you must already be such that you are prepared to hold off on taking that pill now and you'll take it later. Because that is the way, that's going to be the only way in which you have the capacity to know the world in which you live later to exercise. But that requires the idea that you have to have some additional desire that we haven't so far mentioned, because failing to hold on to the pill doesn't interfere with your exercise of your capacity. Right? What it's doing is it's stopping you from making sure that you have the capacity to exercise. So here's a third desire that I'm now going to conjecture you have to have. You have to have the desire that you do what you can now to help make sure that you have the capacity to know the world in which you live and realise your desires in it later to exercise. So now we've got three candidate desires, okay? These three desires look like they've all been argued for actually on very similar lines. You've got to have the desire I'll just say it all again. I know this sounds repetitious, but it's repetitious for a reason. I'm trying to hypnotise you and make you believe whether or not it's true. No, that's not the reason. No. I'm repeating it just because I want to keep it right at the forefront of everyone's mind that we're not smuggling in anything moral here. No moral assumptions have been made. No prudential assumptions have been made. I've merely asked the question, what is required in order to have maximal capacities for knowing the world in which you live and realising your desires in it and to be able to robustly exercise those capacities? So far we've got three desires, right? You've got to have the desire that you don't interfere with your current exercise of your capacity to know your world. You've got to have the desire that you not interfere with the future exercise of capacity to know your world. And you've got to have the desire that you do what you can now to make sure that you have those capacities to exercise. Now, what goes for belief formation and knowledge goes for desire realization. If you are a creature that possesses and robustly exercises the capacity to realize your desires in the world in which you live, not just synchronically but diachronically, then you're potentially a hostage to idiosyncratic desires now about which desires will be realised in the future. You could lay traps now to make sure that certain desires won't be realised in the future. Right? And presumably, if you have a maximal capacity for desire realisation and you robustly exercise it, you'd have to make sure that you don't fall victim to those traps that you lay for yourself. Actually, for anyone who's kind of thinking that they've heard that before, it rings a bell, yes, that is the argument Nagel gives in The Possibility of Altruism. This is the big argument for prudence. Or it's a variation on this argument. So really, what we've got now are six desires. Because everything that was just said about belief goes for desire as well. So if you're an ideal agent, you've really got to have six dominant desires. Now, dominant here means they've got to dominate the idiosyncratic desires, right? That is, the ones that aren't constitutive of what it is to be rational. I'm going to talk a little bit about how they relate to each other in just a tick. But they've got to dominate those idiosyncratic desires. You've got a desire that you don't interfere with your present exercise of your capacity for belief formation or desire realisation. You've got a desire that you don't interfere with your later exercise of your capacity for belief formation or desire realisation. You've got a desire that you do what you can now to make sure that you have capacities for belief formation and desire realisation to exercise. But in the case of desire realisation, there's going to be a crucial proviso. And the proviso is, on condition that the desires whose exercise you would be preventing aren't desires whose realisation requires that you interfere with the belief formation or desire realisation capacity. Okay. So there's that proviso. But since it's such a mouthful, I will never say it again. I'll just take it as read. So the case for desire is exactly like the case for belief, except with the crucial proviso. Okay. Now, again, this would be another natural place to stop, because we've now established that there are really some pretty substantive reasons for action that we all have from premises that are really just about what ideal agents are like. That is, what it's like to be someone who has and maximally exercises robustly so the capacity to know your world and realise your desires in it. But the thing to notice is that the desires we've been talking about so far are all have a characteristic form. They all have a characteristic form. The agent himself figures in two places in the contents of these desires. He figures in what I'm going to call the agent place. You have to desire, all right, you have to desire that you now not interfere with blah, 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 that you now do what you can to help, right? That's the agent place. You're figuring there. And you figure in the patient place. You have to desire that you now don't interfere with your exercise of your capacity to form beliefs, with your exercise of your capacity to realise your desires. You have to make sure that you do what you can to make sure that you have belief formation and desire realisation capacities to exercise. So call that the patient place. That's hence the title of the paper, in case anyone came here thinking it was going to be about free will. You're out of luck. It's got nothing to do with that. So these desires have this characteristic form. The agent himself is figuring in the agent place and in the patient place. But there's another interesting feature. He figures in the agent place in the present, but he figures in the patient place in both the present and the future. Now the question is whether this is a stable stopping point. And there are really two ways, there are two things you could ask. Should we be thinking that agents other than the agent himself should figure in the agent place? Should we be thinking that people other than the agent himself figures in the patient place? Should we be thinking that times other than the present figure in the agent place? They're the questions that we have to ask. Right? Now, having put that question on the table, it just seems to leap out at you that the agent himself in the present has to figure in the agent place. Why? Well, just think of why we started postulating the idea that there are these desires that are constitutive of what it is to be rational. There's a problem. There's a problem that you, as your ideal counterpart, you in the world in which you have and you possess and maximally exercise and robustly so capacities to know the world in which you live and realise your desires in it. There's a problem that in that world, these two capacities don't cohere well with each other. And the postulation of the desires has been to effect a coherence in these two capacities that you possess. But that just means that you have to figure in the agent place, and you have to figure, and the present has to figure in the patient place, in the agent place. Why? Because the problem is one of what you can do here and now to make sure that you are synchronically and diachronically rational. And the only thing you can do is stuff that affects what you do here and now. As Williams puts it in some place or other, all, the perspective of deliberation is from the here and now. Me, here and now. So that's the answer to the first question. That's concerning the logical form of these desires. It's the agent himself who figures in the agent place in the present. Now, what about the patient place? Well, actually, this is much more interesting. I think that there are at least three kinds of arguments that you could give for thinking that the agent himself and cannot be exclusively the one who figures in the patient place. So let me just describe, and I'll just move on quickly, but I'll just describe two very quick arguments that I'm not going to talk about. But there are three arguments, I think. One argument is really just a version of an argument that Derek Parfit gave in Reasons and Persons. Now, what happened there was there's a crucial chapter called The Argument from Full Relativity, in which he argues on really pretty high-level structural grounds that you can't take divergent attitudes in these quantified claims about norms of rationality. You can't take a differential attitude to agents and times. You've got to hold your attitudes to those two in sync. And if you remember, the argument in that chapter was an argument by dilemma. Either you had to be fully neutral in your concerns, or you had to restrict your concerns to yourself in the present. Okay, that was the form of the argument. Now, So here is a deployment of Parfit's argument. We want to know now, we know that the agent himself in the present has to figure in the agent place. Who has to figure in the patient place? Well, we know that other times, other than the present, have to figure in the patient place. But now the Parfit argument tells you that you've just got to be symmetrical with respect to how you're quantifying over agents. So it's got to be that you quantify over all agents. That's the first argument. So it's a high-level structural argument. Okay, so that tells you very roughly that it's constitutive of being rational. I'll just say this now out loud because this is the conclusion that all of these arguments point to. It's constitutive of being rational that you've got to have a dominant desire that you don't interfere with the exercise of anyone's capacities to know their world or realise their desires in it, subject to the crucial proviso, no matter when they exist. And you've got to do what you can to make sure they have those two capacities to exercise. That's going to be the conclusion. Actually, just to leap back to the beginning, I said this is kind of Rawlsian in its upshot. It's no surprise that those two desires pretty much match the first and second principles of justice. That's not a surprise. It's the same idea. Okay, here's the second argument. If it's so much as coherent to imagine a world in which everyone is ideal, if that's so much as coherent, then given that some of those worlds are worlds with other agents, we have to be able to rely on those other agents not interfering with us in exactly the same way we rely on our past selves not to interfere with us. And given that this is just a fact about what it is to be ideal agents, it must be that they've got desires concerning us, just like the desires our past selves have concerning our present selves. But that's just to say that they must have desires, and we must have them too, that we not interfere with any agent. So if it's so much as conceivable that there's a world of all comprising ideal agents, it can't be the case that the agent himself exclusively figures in the patient place. If that argument sounds familiar, it is familiar. That is just the Kantian argument for the kingdom of things. So now, but that's neither of those arguments the argument I want to think about. I want to go back to our little mundane thought experiment, and I want to try and convince you that there's a third argument. So, and this is my version of the Rawlsian thought experiment. So what I want to try and convince you of is that actually, we should be able to give an argument for that conclusion just by focusing on these process of thought cases. Now, in order to do that, here's what we've got to pull off. We've got to describe one of those processes of thought, but we've got to discharge the assumption that the person who you're having an effect on in the future is yourself. Now, can we do that? I'll give it a shot. You ready? Imagine that there's a subject, he's trying to... It's the same case, there's no surprise here, you just have to listen to the way it's told. There's a subject who's trying to figure out whether or not P is true. He's actually completely engrossed in this enterprise. So engrossed, he's oblivious to everything about his surroundings, everything else about his psychology. He's just focused on whether or not P is true. Okay? If it turns out to be true, you can imagine this is a stream of consciousness, if you like. There's a stream of consciousness that's focused on whether or not P is true. If it turns out to be true, the subject will investigate whether or not P supports Q. And if that turns out to be so, then the subject will draw the conclusion that Q. So there's a stream of consciousness that's just the stream that I was describing initially in the first case. The only difference is, well, I guess there are two differences. First of all, I've stipulated that there's a stream of consciousness. Secondly, I've said that the person is so engrossed in these thought processes that he's just not thinking about anything else. Now, here's the question. Now, think of the subject who's trying to figure out whether or not P. What does he have to be like? What does his psychology have to be like if he is to possess maximal capacities that he robustly exercises for belief formation and desire realisation? Okay, here's the answer. The answer is it's exactly the same case as before. So it must be that he possesses those very same desires. So he's got to possess the six desires I've already described. However, there's a crucial difference. And now, you might have thought If you listen carefully, you will have seen that there was this crucial difference. I nowhere said that the subject who was trying to figure out whether P is true is the subject who's trying to figure out whether or not P supports Q and is the subject who's trying to who will go on to draw the conclusion that Q. I didn't say that at any point. So it can't be, since we have the intuition in this case, that it's exactly like the original case. It can't be that what we were thinking at the very beginning was that you had to have desires where the agent himself figured crucially in the patient place. Now, in order to see that that's true, and I didn't pull any rabbits out of hats, let me just talk through the case. And I'm going to do this. My temptation is to say I can do it for any plausible theory of personal identity. So I'm just going to talk through the case, imagining three different views about personal identity. I'm going to show, or I'm going to try and convince you that what I've said is true, no matter which of these three views is correct. And it's kind of a promissory note, if you like. We could sort of imagine that other views could come on stream, but my conjecture is that we could do the same thing. And we learned something actually pretty important by focusing on these three cases. So don't nod off just now. Right? Just don't do that. Okay, so here's the first possibility. Imagine that the Cartesian ego view is the correct. So there's a Cartesian ego that's focused on whether or not P is true. And as it happens, a different Cartesian ego. Although there's a single stream of consciousness, a different Cartesian ego is trying to figure out whether or not P supports Q. And yet a third Cartesian ego goes on to draw the conclusion that Q. Does that make any difference to the thought experiment? And the answer is, for reasons that are kind of familiar, no. Because for all we know, that is the metaphysics of us. I have no idea. I mean, you know, for all I know, there really is a Cartesian ego that's sort of right here now, and there's a different one in a few minutes. I know what's required for the robust rationality of that stream of consciousness because it's the very thing that's required for my robust rationality. And it clearly can't be fixated on whether or not it's the same Cartesian ego. So the desire in question must just be a desire not to interfere with anyone's exercise of that capacity. So that's the first case. Here's the second case. Imagine that the criterion of personal identity is the body criterion. And let's fix on that part of the body that looks most likely to make that come out true, namely the brain. So let's ask whether this thought experiment goes through, even if we imagine or discharge the assumption that it's the same brain throughout. So, surprise, surprise, yes, it does go through. Because what we imagine is there's someone who's trying to figure out whether or not P is true. And just as he's about, he's so engrossed, he doesn't notice any of this, by the way. You've got to imagine that. He's so engrossed in this that he doesn't notice that he suffers a terrible, catastrophic accident that destroys his body. And the surgeons, of course, are on hand, and there's two debrained bodies handy. It's unlikely that you can transplant a brain, but they cut the brain in half and they put lefty in the one body and they put the right half in the other body. And miracle of miracles, the two bodies, the two transplants take. Later on, there are these two bodies with lefty in one side and righty in the other, going, yes, P does support Q, and then draws the conclusion that Q. Now, you really do have to imagine that he really is so intent, he did not notice that he suffered this catastrophic accident, right? So there's a single stream of consciousness up until the catastrophic accident, but then the stream of consciousness divides. Right? Now, go back to when he's trying to figure out whether P is true. Now, in this case, again, I think actually this case is even... So imagine the body criterion. This case seems to me even more decisive. On what possible grounds could someone... And even anticipating that this, discriminate between which of these two candidate continuers they shouldn't be interfering with? The answer is they couldn't possibly discriminate between them because their two cases are described so as to be completely symmetrical. But we know exactly what's required for the robust rationality of the streams of consciousness. It's that the person who's trying to figure out whether or not P is true does not interfere with... Now notice you can't use a pronoun that picks out the agent himself for the future occurrence. You've got to be thinking that he doesn't interfere with anyone's exercise. Okay. Now that case, let's think of now a third case. So here's the third case. Let's imagine that it's the psychological continuity and connectedness view is the correct view of personal identity. So now, here's why it's important that we imagine the case so that he was completely engrossed in the problem, that he was oblivious to what else was going on in his psychology or anything else. Because what I'm going to ask you to imagine is that while the subject is intently figuring out whether or not P is true and then goes on to figure out whether or not P supports Q, there is, of course, the famous nasty neuroscientist Black on hand who changes the remaining surrounding psychology. So it's me at the beginning, but later it's, now, we can have three possibilities. We could say it's my wife's, or we could have it's a child's, or we could have it's a demented, someone who, you know, someone with Alzheimer's, who just so happens to be pulling it off to sort of think through one train of thought. It really doesn't matter. Does it make any difference to the question what's required for the robust rationality of the stream of consciousness? No, it makes no difference whatsoever. But if the psychological continuity and connectedness theory is the correct theory about diachronic identity of persons, it's a different person who's trying to figure out whether or not P, and later trying to figure out whether P supports Q. Now, this case, I think, is really pretty interesting, this last case, because it tells you something more profoundly interesting. What we've already got from these three cases that I've described, I think, is pretty decisive reason to think that it doesn't have to be the agent himself that figures in the patient place. But this last case tells you something else as well. The person who figures in the patient place doesn't have to be psychologically similar to the agent himself. The person who figures in the patient place doesn't even have to have a really robust set of rational capacities. That's what you get out by thinking that it could be a child, say, or someone who's suffering from Alzheimer's, who just happens to be pulling off a successful train of thought in this case. So this makes you wonder, so how do you characterise the being who figures in the patient place? And the answer seems to be that the being who figures in the patient place has to have two really key properties. They've got to be someone who has capacities to know the world in which they live, and so they've got to have the capacities to form beliefs, right, to have knowledge and to realise their desires in it. And here's the crucial other bit. Their exercise of these capacities has to be dependent on what the agent himself now wants and does. That looks like it's the only property that the person in the patient place has to have. So let me just repeat that. They don't have to be psychologically similar. They don't have to have robust capacities for rational reflection. They just have to be dependent. Let's add in a couple more things. They don't have to be engaged in a single stream of consciousness, because we could discharge that assumption too. If you're going to be diachronically rational, you've got to be able to make sure that you don't interfere with belief formation, even if you happen not to be conscious when you're interfering. They don't have to be engaged in processes of thought that are inferentially connected with their current processes, because you've got to have the capacity to make sure that you don't interfere, even if they're not inferentially connected. We can discharge all of those assumptions. All you've got to do is they've got to have capacities to know the world in which they live and realise their desires in it, and their exercise of those capacities has to be dependent on what the agent himself now does. Now, so that's my conjecture. My conjecture is that when you think through properly these norms that govern us just in virtue of being agents, we're struck by a certain kind of problem of coherence between these two capacities, the capacities for belief or to know the world in which you live and realise your desires in it. And there's a privileged way of inducing coherence in the psychology that has those two capacities. It's by imagining that the psychology, in order to be ideal, has to have coherence-inducing desires. And I've mentioned six I've mentioned six desires, right? These all have to be dominant in the sense that they've got to dominate the other idiosyncratic desires you have. Idiosyncratic here just means they're not constitutive of what it is to be rational. You've got to have the desire that you don't interfere with your exercise of your capacity to know the world in which you live or realise your desires in it, now or in the future. Sorry, start again. You've got to have the desire that you do not interfere with the capacity to know the world in which they live or realise desires in it of any being whose exercise of those capacities is dependent on what you now want. You've got to have the desire that you not interfere with the exercise of the capacity to know the world in which they live or realise the desires in it of any future creature whose capacity is dependent on what you now want. And you've got to have the desire, now that you do what you can, to make sure that any creature whose exercise of capacity is dependent on what you now want has capacities to exercise. These look like these desires are constitutive of what it is to be rational. Now, they potentially conflict with each other. And I'll just sort of end up by mentioning that and then I'll stop. They potentially conflict with each other because you can imagine a case in which, let me just describe a case. You can imagine a case in which, say, you have been inflicted with a disease that's going to prevent you. It's going to be sort of deterioration. You know, you're going to lose your capacity to know your world. Now, there's a drug you can take. But unfortunately, the drug is crucially dependent on mood. So it's really important that you believe you're going to get well. So there's a second pill you can take. And that induces in you the belief that you'll get better. Now, the thing about a case like that is, it's an interesting case because it tells you that the desires that are constitutive of being rational are potentially at war with themselves. The desire you've got to have that you have these capacities to exercise is going to be telling you to take the pill to improve your mood so that the drug that you're taking will work. On the other hand, the desire you have not to interfere with your exercise of your capacity to know your world, here and now, is telling you not to. Now, what this suggests to me, at any rate, is that there must be some scaling of these desires, and presumably you'd have to do it by circumstance or circumstance by circumstance. You'd have to look at the cases and try and figure out how these conflicts are properly resolved. And I don't claim to have a story about that. So there's unfinished business. But it does tell you something important about these desires. Namely, they induce more coherence, but they don't remove it they don't remove conflict altogether. Now, does this mean that you're actually, at the end of the day, no better off than the separate scores conception that I began with at the beginning? And the answer is no, you're much better off. You're much better off because we now know that there are principled ways of resolving any residual conflicts. It depends on what rationality demands of you vis-a-vis knowing your world and having capacities to exercise your desire in it. So that's the little filter, if you like, the little coda of unfinished business, something more that needs to be done. But now let me just summarise that. It turns out that the question was, can you draw substantive conclusions about reasons for action that agents have from premises about the desires of their idealised counterparts, where the norms of idealisation are just the norms internal to agency, that is, norms that you have to be subject to just because you know your world and you can realise your desires in it? And the answer is yes. Everyone, let's just put it in a pithy formulation, everyone has a reason not to interfere and to help. Not to interfere with belief formation or desire realisation capacities of anybody who's exercised those capacities and depend on what they now do, and to make sure that people have those capacities to exercise. If they sound to you like Rawls's first principle in the first case and Rawls's second principle in the second case, correct. They are those two principles. With one crucial difference, Rawls's principles have this horrible feature that the only patients are people who are rationally excellent because they have to be fit for cooperation. The story I've got isn't a cooperative story at all. It's got nothing to do with cooperation. It's just got to do with what's required in order to be a rational thinker and desire realiser. And it turns out that you've got those obligations to any creature who has those capacities, children, the mentally defective, animals, and so on. That's, I think, a good conclusion. So I'll stop there. Thank you.